Metcast, Sunday, September 20th, 2015. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the show. Well, it is another hot day here in paradise in Southern California. And of course, that means here in the studio under the stairs, the broom cupboard. Yeah, it's going to get warm in here before we get to the end of this, because we got lots of things to talk about. We always have lots of stuff to talk about, right? Tons of stuff to talk about. Tons of stuff going on. We've got new operating system out for iOS. We got to talk about strong iPhone sales, or how iPhone sales are doing. I guess I just gave away the lead there. What's going on with Apple TV? Developers are getting their hands on those, and we're starting to get some more information about that. Also, iPad Pro availability, along with iPad Minis, new iPad Minis hitting the streets. And going to talk about some of those things, more on the Apple Car, and a whole bunch more in the news. And then we're going to talk a little bit more and follow up on some things from last week with regards to doing a clean install. Also, I'm going to clarify some of the comments that I made. Got some great feedback for you on Apple's iPhone payment plans. And then we've got a couple of questions. And also, we're going to deep dive a little bit into what you can do with iOS 9. I've got some tips and tricks and hints and all of that stuff. Also, a little bit on some issues I've had recently with iOS 9. So we're going to dive in, but before we get into all of that, let me take a brief moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Bushel. For some people, IT is a task and not a career. Bushel is a simple-to-use cloud-based tool that anyone can leverage to manage the Apple devices in their workplace. And it's got a bunch of great features to enable you to do that. Things like device inventory, right? You got to keep track of all those devices that you're managing in the workplace. Also, app distribution. You've got new apps that come out. You need to roll those out to multiple platforms or multiple devices. They may not be local. They may be in different regions. Bushel is a tool that will let you do that. It allows you to do streamlined enrollment, also manage things like the Wi-Fi and email settings on all those devices. And they have a bunch of security features that are helpful as well. Things like remote lock and wipe functions, also disk encryption to keep your corporate data safe. And here's another kind of cool thing, managed open-in, so you can control what apps documents can be opened in, and they have a whole bunch more, and you can do this with as many devices as you want at once. And one of the awesome things about Bushel is how simple and easy it is to use. It is a web-based tool, and while other tools like Bushel usually require an IT background knowledge, Bushel was made to be intuitive so that anybody could use it to benefit their business without having to take a lot of time to do so. And because it's in the cloud, the results are immediate response from any location with any device. So you can be anywhere managing devices that are also anywhere. And the prices are incredibly affordable. Actually, it starts at free, and that really makes it even easier to make the decision to manage your devices with Bushel. So you can get Bushel for free on up to three devices. You can manage up to three devices completely for free when you sign up at bushel.com/maccast. And again, that's not a trial. You actually get three devices free forever. So you can test it out, evaluate it, see if it's really going to work with actual devices. And then they have other plans that you can upgrade into as you need to add and manage more devices. I really encourage you to check it out. And a big thank you to Bushel for being a sponsor of the MacCast. Remember, that's bushel.com/MacCast for your free account. As you probably know by now, the new iPhones, the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus, went on sale about a week ago. And while we don't have exact numbers, we do know that things are looking pretty good. According to Apple, they say they were on pace to beat last year's opening weekend sales record of 10 million iPhones. So now we're a week or so further into it, and they probably have well surpassed that record. We don't know exactly. They never came back and updated and said if they did beat that 10 million in the opening weekend record. But if you look at Apple's website, you can see now that most versions of the iPhones are shipping in between 3 to 6 weeks, at least on the Plus models and specifically the Rose Gold models. The Rose Gold color seems to have been extremely popular, and I don't know if that's just because it's the new thing or if it's a color that people really are looking forward to and prefer. But beyond that, it does look like that you can still, at least in my last check, get some of the 6S models, again, other than the Rose Gold, still shipped by the 25th. So if you order quick shipping at this point, you should be able to get it. But Rose Gold by far sold out the quickest. I think within just a few minutes on order day, those were selling out. iPhone 6S and 6S deliveries for pre-orders will begin arriving this Friday, the 25th of September, although some customers in New York City and Philly might not get their shipments if Apple is shipping things via UPS. That's because apparently Pope Francis is going to be in town doing some tours in those areas between the 24th and 25th, and UPS has posted a temporary service notice on their website stating that no pickups or deliveries were going to be available for some areas. I have a list of the impacted zip codes in the show notes at maccast.com. You can also check on the UPS website. Again, if you're in New York City or Pennsylvania, it's not all of the state, you know, it's not the entire state or the entire city, obviously, but just specific zip codes. So you'll want to check there. And if you are impacted, you probably want to go on to UPS's website or use the UPS app, and you could possibly opt to have your device shipped to a holding facility, a UPS facility, and go pick it up there. Now, remember, too, that Apple does use FedEx and other carriers, so if you're not with UPS, you may or may not be impacted, but just something to keep an eye on if you're expecting to get your iPhone shipment on Friday. So pay attention when you get your shipping receipt to see how Apple shipped your device. And if you are in one of the impacted regions, you know, take some measures to make sure that you can still get your device on launch day. As we just noted, in addition to the Rose Gold models, iPhone 6S Plus models seem to be in a little bit shorter supply than the iPhone 6. And KGI security analyst Ming Chai Kuo has a theory as to why. He says that the backlight module production is having issues at one of Apple's Japanese suppliers, Mindbay, and that has slowed down production of the iPhone 6S Plus models. He does go on to say that Apple has tapped Radiant, another one of their suppliers, to help keep up supplies, and hopefully that's why we're only seeing 3 to 4 week delays right now on the iPhone 6S Plus shipments. Now, Apple made a statement that seems to contradict, or as we know, Apple's never really going to explain why they might have shortages, but they came out officially and said that demand simply outpaced supply on the iPhone 6S Plus models versus their pre-sale supply forecasts, and that's why you're actually seeing a shortage with availability still going on the iPhone 6S. Now, depending on where you are in the world, an iPhone might cost you a little bit more than it does here in the States. The Telegraph crunched some of the numbers around the world and found that France and Germany are the most expensive places to buy an iPhone. That's after you do the conversion rates and taxes are applied. They say in those regions, iPhones are about 30% more expensive. After France and Germany, it's the UK that comes in with the most expensive iPhone, and they kind of looked at the 16-gigabyte iPhone 6S model. So in the UK, for example, the price came out to, or is, rather, £539. That translates to about $832.73 US, or about $183.73 more than the US advertised price. Now, keep in mind, these are straight conversions, and they don't really tell the whole story about pricing. European prices tend to have a value-added tax tacked on to the price, and we're also adjusting here, obviously, for exchange rates, and the pricing in other regions also does account for any kind of import tariffs or taxes. In the U.S., taxes are not factored into the published price. So, for example, some U.S. states have taxes as high as 9 or 10%. So you need to tack that onto the price depending upon which state you're in. And some states have no sales tax at all, so that throws the gap off as well. All of this to really point out that despite the pricing differences between various regions, in general, it's not pure profit taking. It's not like the increases increased prices are to add additional revenue going straight into Apple's coffers. A lot of it is accounting for these global economic differences. And another point being made in the piece over at the Telegraph is that in the UK, Apple is still selling iPhones at last year's prices, despite the pound being a lot weaker against the dollar at the same time. And the same is going for China. So they could have done even larger increases, and it appears that they didn't. They chose not to do that. And then another thing in the UK, just to point out, is you do get a better deal on some of Apple's services, like Apple Music subscriptions, which have been straight converted to pounds from US dollars. So here in the States, a subscription will run you $9.99. It is also priced at £9.99 in the UK. I think that's how you say it, £9.99. Probably going to show that I'm a total yank and don't understand UK dollars, but you get the point. It is just a straight conversion there, so you do get a little better deal in some areas. And then another few other things on iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. A number of people have been asking, will the old cases fit the new model devices? So if you have an iPhone 6 now, will it fit? Will your case fit the iPhone 6S? And it's looking like the answer is yes. As a matter of fact, Apple's website notes that both its leather and silicone cases for the iPhone 6S and the 6S Plus will also fit the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus. So it should work just fine. And then if you've been holding on to that legacy AT&T unlimited data plan, there's some good news for you if you upgrade and choose to continue on that plan. AT&T is now going to let you use up to 22 gigabytes of data per month without getting data throttled. Previously on those unlimited plans, I had heard of people getting throttled after using as little as 2 to 3 gigabytes of data. So that's actually a pretty nice big increase. And I have a feeling it has a little bit to do with a lawsuit they had to settle recently. But just speculating. Anyway, that's the latest on the iPhone 6 and 6S Plus. For us mere mortals, the Apple TV will not be available for probably another month or so, but Apple did hold a Apple TV developer kit lottery for developers so that they can build and start to test apps for the new Apple TV. That being one of the big features, of course, we want them to have a lot of cool apps available on launch day. So Apple did this little lottery, developers could sign up, and now the lucky chosen developers are just starting to get their units. It started to happen sort of mid to end of this past week. And something really cool is that those that got picked, and it was supposed to be totally random. I don't know if it was totally random, but Apple says it was random. Those people that did get picked were charged just US $1 for the privilege of getting a new Apple TV. And when they arrived, we started to see some unboxings. And one really cool thing is it looked like it had special developer edition packaging around it. As a matter of fact, on the side of the box, it said, "As not yet seen on TV," was one of the taglines. In the box, there's the Apple TV unit itself, also a Siri remote, of course, along with a power cord, a Lightning to USB cable, and also, very interestingly, a USB-A to USB-C cable, because now the diagnostic port is actually a USB-C connector and no longer a USB micro connector. I think it's the micro connector, not the mini, that was on the current generation Apple TV. And so that's basically what you'd use to plug in if you wanted to do a software restore directly from iTunes to the Apple TV. I also think it's what's used for doing a lot of the diagnostics and error logging and things like that, which is probably why they included it in the developer models. It's unclear whether or not in the final production versions if we'll get that USB-A to USB-C cable. My guess is that that specific cable would not ship in the final unit, so that's something exclusive for these developer models. But now that they're in the hands of developers, we have a couple of interesting discoveries that have happened. One is that when you pick up the remote, if you have it set up with the CEC, Consumer Electronic Control, on your HDMI, it sounds like it will actually turn on the TV. So we know it's got gyroscopes and sensors in there. It can detect when you pick up the remote and automatically turn on your television and the Apple TV, which is kind of handy. Also, old Apple TV remotes will continue to work, so there still is the IR port on the Apple TV. The actual new Siri remote also does have an IR port on it. I think we mentioned this in the last episode, but people have asked, you know, will it still have IR and not be just Bluetooth? And yes, it is. So that means you can control the volume on your TV as well with the Apple TV remote or the Siri remote. Another cool thing that got announced not long after, because the new Apple TV is going to have apps, both Plex and VLC have announced that they plan to make versions of their apps for the new Apple TV. As a matter of fact, VLC says that they still have a ways to go, but they've already achieved video playback on the new Apple TV unit. And unfortunately, some developers have chosen not to work with their Apple TV dev kits, but rather sell them for a hefty profit on eBay, considering the fact that they're showing up on eBay and Craigslist, some going for as high as $1,000. I'm not really sure that's part of the terms of service, or that Apple's going to be very happy about that if you're one of the developers who's actually selling their Apple TV unit, the dev unit, but it is going on. And, you know, anybody could have signed up for this who's in the developer program. I happen to be in the developer program, but specifically chose not to put myself in the lottery because I'm not going to develop an Apple TV app. And I really wanted to make sure that the developers who were very interested in having a cool app on the Apple TV were able to get their hands on one of these for testing. And then remember last week I told you that with the Apple TV remote and the gaming features on the Apple TV, that there was something in the developer guidelines that said that developers could force purchasers of their game to have an MFI game controller, that they could say this game requires the use of an MFI game controller. Apparently, Apple has reversed their decision on that language and is now saying that to develop a game for tvOS and the new Apple TV, you must support the Apple TV remote, and your game may not require the use of a controller. So that's a complete reversal there. They also say that tvOS games that support controllers must support the extended control layout, and that your games must be playable using standalone controllers, and also that your game must support the pause button on the remote. So quite a few more restrictions regarding the control device that you can use with your game on the Apple TV. That's caused a little bit of debate. You know, is this a good thing or a bad thing? I personally feel because the Apple TV is really targeted, I think, at more casual gamers, that this is going to be a pretty smart requirement, that you kind of have a basic level of control that you can do with the Apple remote. If you have a game that's a little more advanced, you could provide additional controls with a third-party game controller. But, you know, it'd be a little weird if you're going on the App Store on the Apple TV and all you have is the built-in remote and you're encountering the situation where you can't purchase specific games because your controller is not going to be supported. And as I think about this, I think about some of the games, the direct download games that were available on my Wii, and some of them would require a specific controller, and you were basically locked out or sort of blocked from being able to buy those. There was some people who said that with the original rules that Apple had worked out a way where if you did not have a third-party MFI game controller paired with your new Apple TV and you were in the Apple Store or the App Store, you simply just wouldn't see certain games if they required a third-party controller, which would be fine, but then you also have sort of a restricted or limited view of what's available in the App Store. So that could be a little bit odd. So I think this is ultimately a good decision. There is kind of a flip side of the argument, and one of those being that it could limit the kind of control you have on your game, because with the built-in Siri remote, you really just have a directional pad, which is on the trackpad. You have the accelerometer, and you have just one button. There are several other buttons on the remote, but in terms of doing game controls, you have one button. Now, there's really a second button because you can click the trackpad. So what I had read was clicking on the trackpad would work as like an A button. And then I think pressing the play button or the Siri button acted as the B button. But when you think about it, clicking the same thing that you use to control movement in a game could really throw things off depending upon how the game is. So that is a somewhat limiting factor, but I'm thinking that game developers are just going to have to get a little bit creative about the, you know, the controls in their game and how they work with the Apple TV. Will it disrupt the success of games on the Apple TV? I really don't think it's going to make a very big impact, Apple actually reversing this decision. I can get how, you know, certain games like first person shooters or maybe more traditional game console style games might be inhibited by this restriction. But again, I don't think that's the large target market for games on the Apple TV. I think hardcore gamers are going to stick with their Xbox or their PlayStation or their Nintendo box. They're really not going to substitute an Apple TV. So this is a whole different market. And I think Apple wants to make sure that it's open to all of their consumers, even the ones who aren't going to invest in a third-party game controller. And then finally, I got some great questions about the Apple TV, the new Apple TV from listener Mark, and I wanted to bring them up. He said, one, is there a way to migrate the current settings from your current third-gen Apple TV over to a new Apple TV? And I really don't know the answer to this. I would guess that the answer is likely no, though, because tvOS is new on the new Apple TV, and the current version of the OS is completely different. So I don't think there's going to be a way to simply transition your settings. And specifically what Mark was concerned about was, you know, all those channels that you have to go in and you have to authorize and you have to set up if you have a cable subscription. That whole process is a giant pain in the rear, as many of us know. And just the thought of upgrading to a new Apple TV and having to reset all those up. Yeah, Mark, I'm with you. That sounds a little bit painful, but unfortunately, I think you are going to have to do that. The second question was that with the Siri remote, we do know that Apple also has support for iPhones and iPods as to be used as remotes using the remote app. The question was, is there going to be an update to the remote app that would allow you to use the Siri features with the Apple TV if you're using the remote app on your iPhone or your iPod Touch? And as you may or may not know, the new Siri remote has a mic built into it so that you can issue Siri commands to the new Apple TV. So the question being is, are you going to be able to do that if you're using the app on iPhone or iPod Touch? And I would think that Apple would come out with an update that would allow that. So if you don't have your Siri remote handy and you're using the app on your iPhone, you'd be able to use the mic built into your iPhone and actually issue those Siri commands. That just seems to make sense to me. I don't know why Apple would limit that. So Mark, I fully expect that to happen, but we will find out when the thing is actually shipping. And maybe one of the developers out there can answer that question for us if they've got their Apple TV at this point. I just haven't seen anything about that yet, but some great questions and some great new information regarding the new Apple TV. And so the new Apple TV should be arriving sometime next month. And following that, we should be able to go on and order the new iPad Pro, which is supposed to come out sometime in November. Now, getting a new iPad Pro, that may be a little bit tricky because one, I think demand is going to be high, but also two, Digitimes is saying that Apple is experiencing some panel shortages for the iPad Pro and it could affect the initial availability. So there may not be as many units to go around when Apple gets to launch time in November. Of course, sounds like they have some time to maybe fix things, but according to the claim, Digitimes says that Apple may just have about 3 million units ready to go at launch. Digitimes is providing very few details other than saying there is shortages or display shortages in the supply chain. We just don't know specifically with which part of the display. Right now, Sharp is reportedly supplying the bulk of the displays themselves, with Samsung Display and TPK serving as secondary suppliers. GIS is actually responsible for the touch modules in the displays, also doing the lamination and the LCD assembly. So it could be an issue at any one of those points. It remains to be seen how high demand for the iPad Pro will be, but just to put things in perspective, Apple sold 12.3 million iPads total in the fourth quarter. So that would be the iPad, the iPad Air, and the iPad Mini. And that is compared to 14.1 million iPads sold in the same quarter, fourth quarter of 2013. So iPad sales have been declining, as we've talked about on the show, but unit numbers still remain pretty strong. The question is how is the iPad Pro going to break up the sort of breakout of who buys which models? I have a feeling, at least initially, demand is going to be very, very high for the iPad Pro. I know I'm very excited about it. I'm planning on getting the full package, an iPad Pro, 128 gigabyte model, not the Wi-Fi, not the LTE, but also with the smart keyboard cover and the Apple Pencil. And I have a feeling a lot of people are going to be jumping on the iPad Pro bandwagon. So if Apple is having some supply shortages, it could be a classic thing where supplies run out and we start to see back orders pretty quickly. But that's pretty much par for the course now with any Apple product launch, right? And there's going to be issues. And of course, Apple has backup suppliers and they will readjust and readapt. And they're usually pretty good about it. So even if initial supplies sell out, usually a month or two later, Apple has sort of worked out any supply chain issues and they're back on track. Another reason why iPad Pro sales might be higher than expected is a theory that Tim Cook has had for a long time and something that I'm starting to somewhat agree with. And that is that at some point here, we're going to see a major shift where tablets and tablet-like devices like the iPad are going to surpass or overtake laptops or even desktops as people's primary computing platform. And as a matter of fact, Tim Cook was asked recently in a BuzzFeed interview about the iPad Pro, and he said this: "I think that some people will never buy a computer because I think now we're at the point where the iPad does what some people want to do with their PCs." And I fully agree with that. I'm not saying, and Tim Cook wasn't saying in this interview either, that the Mac was going away anytime soon or that desktops or laptops were going away, just that for a certain segment of the market, it will be going away. There's going to be some people who will never own a Mac or a laptop or a desktop as we think about them traditionally. And so I agree, we're kind of at this pivot point, and I think one of the reasons for Apple bringing the iPad Pro out now is it's the right time. A lot of people have been critical about Apple sort of copying the Surface, but a lot of this stuff is about timing. Apple could have done an iPad Pro years ago, and they probably even had it ready to go years ago. I'm just speculating here, but it's a matter of where are we at in sort of the evolution of computing platforms. And I think there's a lot of people in the marketplace. My mom is a great example of this. People who have an iPad and really it does everything they need it to do. And if Apple can give another option, an add-on keyboard, a stylus, these sorts of things, expand that functionality, it creates this ability for them to never need to buy what we would call a traditional notebook or desktop. And I'm right in line with this. I think we're going to see this is very, very interesting. And a lot of people worry about, well, Apple's going to cannibalize their sales and things like that. If you look at where Apple's sales are, it's really iPhones and then iPads and then Macs. You know, look at the latest quarterly results and they make more money from iPhones and iPads than they do from their Mac market share. And I think that trend is only going to continue. Again, this is not saying that the Mac is dead or going to be gone. We're always going to need that. But this is this classic thing. Tim Cook talked about cars and trucks, or that might have been Steve Jobs that talked about cars and trucks. But you get the point, is there's a lot more cars on the road. You know, these things that get us from point A to point B, they don't do a lot of heavy lifting, but they get the job done. You know, they carry people around and passengers. And that's going to serve the needs of most people. And sort of iPads and tablets and things like that are going to be that way. And then you're going to have things like the trucks where you need to get big shipments from point A to point B. They need to do a lot of heavy lifting. They need to do a lot of extra stuff. But a relatively smaller amount of consumers actually need that. And that's where you're getting into your Mac Pros and your MacBook Pros where you're needing to do 3D modeling and development. There's going to be specific jobs that are always going to be appropriate for a truck. And some people are going to use both, right? But I think we are at this sort of pivot time. And I believe it so wholeheartedly that, as a matter of fact, when I get my iPad Pro, I fully intend, and I will be reporting my experience here on the MacCast, I fully intend to spend a month where I don't know if I'm going to literally bolt my MacBook Pro to my desk, but at least figuratively, I am going to bolt it to my desk, and I am going to try to do all of my mobile computing tasks on the iPad Pro. It's going to be an interesting experiment, and I'll learn a lot coming out of it to find out, you know, is Tim Cook right? Are we really at this transition point where a lot of us can get away with something like an iPad Pro versus a notebook? So that means mobile podcast recording for me. That means my note-taking, answering emails, doing all those things that I do. Maybe even video editing and photo editing. I don't really know. You know, I think sometimes we don't pay attention to all the little tasks that we do on a computer in a given day or over a given week, right? They're just the sort of things that we do, and we just do them because we have the tools. And I'll have a new tool, and it'll be interesting to see how things work out. So you'll be coming along for the ride. I'll be sharing that on future episodes. But I'm very excited, if you cannot tell, about the future of the iPad, and specifically the iPad Pro. So have you upgraded to iOS 9 yet? iOS 9 is out. You can get it via software update. And we're going to talk more on a lot of the great features and stuff that are in there a little bit later. But apparently many of us have already upgraded. According to Mixpanel, they say 22% of the overall iOS user base has already upgraded to iOS 9. And I think I read somewhere that that surpasses the number of people who are already running Android Lollipop, the latest version of Android, which that seems to always happen. I don't know why people like to throw out that number, but, you know, I guess it's interesting to see how quickly iOS users upgrade. But, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. We've talked about many of them, right? One of them being that iOS tends to be very backward compatible with older devices. I also think Apple's a little bit more aggressive about forcing users to upgrade, or sort of telling you that there's an update available and getting you to click that OK button. So there's that factor to it. And also with Android, they have to go through a lot of the carriers to actually get new versions of the operating system out to devices. And then just the sheer number of devices and variances of hardware, right? There's all of these reasons for that. But needless to say, it means that iOS 9 adoption is going very well. It sounds like it's at least on track with adoption for iOS 8 and may even actually surpass it. Now, that's not to say the upgrading went simply for everyone. There have been some reports of some people encountering what's being called a slide to upgrade bug. Apparently, after updating, you get to the slide to upgrade screen, but it's completely unresponsive. Nothing happens and you can't do anything. If you did run into this issue, there is a workaround. It's not necessarily easy, but it can be done. Basically, you want to connect your device to your Mac running iTunes via the USB cable, and then in iTunes, select your device from the devices list. And if you don't see it there, you'll have to do a force restart of your iPhone. So hold down the home and the sleep wake button for several seconds until you see the Apple logo to restart it. But once you can see the device in iTunes, you want to select it, and then you want to select restore backup, and that's in the little backups box. And then find your most recent backup, choose that, and restore. If you don't have a recent backup, before you do that, absolutely select your device and click the Backup Now button so that you make sure that you have a current backup. But really, before you run, I guess this is just good general advice and reminder, before you run the iOS update, I would really recommend, even if you're doing an iCloud backup, that you connect your iPhone into iTunes and manually run a backup via iTunes, and check the box that says to encrypt the backup, because that will actually save a lot of your settings and passwords and things like that. If you don't check that, you'll have to reset that stuff up. So when you're pulling that backup right before doing an iOS upgrade, you definitely want to check that box and make sure you have your backup. But hopefully, if you've run into the slide to upgrade bug, that will get you past that issue. Now, you may have noticed also that along with iOS 9, watchOS 2 was supposed to be released, but it has now been delayed. That's because Apple has discovered a bug in watchOS 2. It's taking them a little bit longer to fix the bug than they expected, and so they've chosen to delay the release. Now, Apple's not specifically saying what the bug is, and this isn't for certain, but PCalc developer James Thompson might have been the person that discovered the bug. And if the bug he discovered is what's causing the delay, what it is there's a fair play error that has stopped some watchOS 2 apps, some of the new native apps that we're getting in watchOS 2, from actually being able to run. So that would be a pretty significant, I think, show-stopping bug, and would cause Apple to kind of delay the release until they can get that figured out. I guess it's not happening with all applications, because there have been native apps out for developers running the beta program, and not everybody's run into issues. But whatever the bug is, Apple has delayed the release of watchOS 2. Hopefully we'll see it sometime next week. I don't think it should be very much longer. And I know a lot of us, myself included, are looking forward to the new OS, because it's got a bunch of great features like third-party complications and the new native apps. I mean, that's really what I'm most excited about, to see what developers do with that. So that really does need to be rock solid and working before Apple puts it out. So I'm happy to let them take the additional time that they need to make sure that that is a good experience. And for those of you in Austria, Denmark, or Ireland, it looks like Apple Watch is going to be on sale to you on Friday, September 25th. So hopefully by the time that release happens, they will have the new version of watchOS 2, and you'll be able to actually test it out and play with that in those countries as well. Apple seems to be continuing to expand Apple Watch sales. They're getting into new markets, also into new stores and retail locations. So being pretty aggressive, it seems, about getting Apple Watch out to the world. Along with the release of iOS 9, Apple did do a small update to iTunes. iTunes 12.3 was released. The update includes updates to support OS 10.11 El Capitan. And I apologize, somebody pointed out I kept calling LCAP 10.10. Obviously, 10.10 is OS 10 Yosemite, so apologize if in prior episodes that caused any confusion. 10.11 El Capitan, that should arrive on 9:30, but with the update to iTunes, it will be ready for it. iTunes 12.2 also improved Apple Music accessibility with VoiceOver, resolved a problem that prevented ordering of songs within the Up Next playlists, fixed a problem where some radio stations did not appear within the recently played menu, addressed an issue where songs you loved on iOS did not appear loved in iTunes. So apparently there wasn't enough love going around, or at least it wasn't syncing up, and also added support for the new two-factor authentication that is available using your Apple ID. And then, of course, it also has the usual improvements and overall stability and performance, along with security updates. So if you haven't run software update and received the new version of iTunes 12.3, you might want to grab that. And then one other minor update that kind of goes along with iOS 9, Apple did update iMovie for iOS. The big thing there is they added support for 4K video editing, which is going to be possible when the iPhone 6S and 6S Pluses arrive at the end of next week. You can also now run 1080p video at 60 frames per second in iMovie. It has support for the new 3D touch gestures that will be coming with the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. Something else I saw in there that is going to be a nice update is the option to actually disable the Ken Burns animation for a photo in iMovie. Added support for slide over and split view multitasking with the iMovie extension for photos, and also general performance and stability improvements, along with a whole bunch of other tweaks. So if you are a heavy iMovie for iOS user, you probably want to grab this update as well. And that's some of the latest that's going on with Apple software updates. The iPad Mini 4 is now shipping out to consumers, and of course that means we're starting to get benchmarks and teardowns. Geekbench was one of the first out with some benchmark scores, and that gave some information about the processors. It's looking like the iPad Mini 4 is running an A8 processor, not an A8X like in the iPad Air 2, although that A8 does run at 1.5 gigahertz, which is clocked just slightly faster than the A8 that's found in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. That one runs at 1.4 gigahertz. So a lot of people, and myself included, had said the iPad Mini was basically a shrunk down iPad Air. It is in most senses, I guess, all the way down to, but not including, the processor. The processor is slightly different. The A8 is a 64-bit dual-core processor, where the A8X is actually a triple-core processor. It also looks like the GPUs might be slightly different, although still upgraded. The iPad Mini 4 appears to have a PowerVR GX6450 chip. For comparison, the iPad Air 2 has a GXA6850 chip, so slightly different there. It does have 2 gigabytes of RAM, just like the iPad Air 2, and it is smaller and thinner. It has a thinner single-cell battery that's a little bit smaller, 5,124 milliamp hours versus the 6,741 milliamp hour battery of the iPad Mini 3. Another interesting design change that Apple made is the Wi-Fi antennas inside the iPad Mini 4 are now split. You actually have one on the top next to the camera and another near the bottom, on the bottom near the speaker. So I don't know. I would assume that would improve maybe reception, especially depending upon how you're holding the device versus having the antennas just on one end. And again, the whole thing is overall thinner at 6.1 millimeters. And Apple was able to achieve that by slimming down a lot of the internal components, including things like the FaceTime camera, the LCD in front glass, and of course that battery, as we just mentioned. And then, in case you missed it, there actually is a new accessory for the iPad Mini 4, and that comes in the form of a new silicone case. It's available in the same colors as the iPad Mini Smart Cover and will actually work with Smart Cover. It costs $59 US, and I guess it's meant to replace the actual smart case, the iPad Mini smart case, which Apple had for the iPad Mini 3, which was actually a leather case. I think that was priced at $79. But now, if you want to get a full case solution, you'll have to get the silicone back cover combined with the iPad Mini smart cover. I think the iPad Mini smart cover runs $39 US, and then you add that to the $59 for this silicone case, and it's priced a little bit higher than the prior generation smart case. So some people are a little bit upset about that, a little higher pricing. I guess it depends on what you want to go for. You know, are you a case person where you want the whole thing enclosed front and back, or are you a smart cover only person? This seems to have a little more flexibility and options versus just a smart case solution. But, you know, your opinion may vary. Apple opened a new Apple Store this week, and by new Apple Store, I mean one that has an all-new design. It's Apple's newest retail store. It opened in Brussels, Belgium, and it's the first one that has been designed under the watch of Jony Ive. So it has huge glass panels that go over all the way around the front and the side. I think it's kind of got a curved edge, if I remember from the pictures. The pictures are amazing. This place looks incredible. There's actually live trees in the store, so there's actually planters in there. I think it has a ceiling that lets in additional light, so those trees can actually survive. Apple has replaced a lot of the side panel backlit displays like you see in a lot of the Apple retail stores with a massive video wall that can change. And I guess they also will double as a training screen when they're bringing in people to do training. The tables have been revamped a little bit. They look similar in terms of the overall design, but they're being made from a new material. They're now made of a redwood, and they have these cool power outlets in the back of them that will actually pop open when you touch near the table. You sort of swipe near this little panel and it pops up to give you power ports and additional things to plug into. I don't know if those are for consumers or only just for like the geniuses and the people that are helping you with your one-to-one appointments and things like that. I would imagine it's the latter and that they're not there just for consumers. Another cool thing is a lot of the wall units, the display cases where you find accessories and products, they now just have the product sort of hanging there in front of a little square. And those are actually pull-out drawers that when you pull them out, they'll have the cases and things like that stocked behind the actual display unit. It looks very sleek and very clean, even more so, I think, than the current Apple retail stores. And you've got a lot more stone and wood, a lot more natural materials versus the steel and just glass. It's still a lot of glass, but kind of the stainless steel is going by the wayside, it seems like. And if you're wondering when we're going to get one of these new designs here in the US, it's looking like the first sort of revamp is going to be the Apple Store in Germantown, Memphis. So you'll have to travel to Memphis if you're in the States to see this new store design. But really, if you haven't had a chance, go online and look for pictures of the new Apple retail store in Brussels. And I think you will be blown away kind of by the look of the whole thing. It really is a nice change. And believe it or not, even kind of upscales from where Apple is already. Apple may be getting ready to introduce Apple Pay in China at least sometime soon, or at least they're making steps toward getting that done. The Wall Street Journal reported this week that Apple created a company in the Shanghai Free Trade Zones specifically for operating Apple's Apple Pay business in China. They also seeded that company with apparently $13.4 million of capital. China actually could be a very huge market for Apple Pay because they already have well adopted mobile payments. As a matter of fact, Alipay, which is run by the e-commerce giant Alibaba, already has over 300 million users in China. Apple still does need to get regulatory approval to launch Apple Pay in the country, but there have been talks that Apple may partner with Alibaba to actually make that happen. It would be one way to, I guess, apparently speed things up. But regardless, Apple continuing to push out Apple Pay into other countries, and it sounds like they have their sights set firmly on getting something going in China relatively soon. I think that could be a big move, again, because of the success and adoption of mobile payments as a platform in that region. And Apple continues to expand Apple Pay in the UK. They rolled it out there as the second country. I think they're also trying to get a rollout going in Canada sometime soon, but recently they added Halifax and Lloyds as banks to Apple Pay in the UK. That brings the total number of banks there up to 11. And believe me, I'm trying so hard not to do a Spinal Tap joke right now. But regardless, Apple Pay continuing to expand in the UK. And then finally in the news for this week, some more updates on Apple's rumored Apple Car project. Does anybody doubt at this point that Apple is working on some sort of vehicle? Not that they will actually produce a vehicle. I think that's still up for debate. But the fact that Apple is experimenting with car technology and either a autonomous or an electric vehicle or possibly both or some combination of the two, I don't know, but they're working on something. And this week, The Guardian claims that Apple senior legal counsel Mike Maletic held a hour-long meeting with the California Department of Motor Vehicles last month to review autonomous vehicle regulations. And basically, Apple would be required, if they were going to do autonomous vehicle testing in California, to get an autonomous vehicle testing permit from the California DMV. So the assumption is he was there, you know, looking into that because that might be something that Apple needs to pursue. And why would they need to pursue that? Probably because they want to test an autonomous vehicle, right, on public roads in California. So you need that license. Although it is being noted that because Apple is so secretive about this stuff, that they may not ultimately go that route. So I think what's going on is he was probably doing some research, figuring out what was going to be involved. What's going on is that manufacturers that apply for a permit actually need to make a lot of details public, including like the make and the model of the vehicle, the vehicle's VIN number, the vehicle identification number of any cars that they want to test. And Apple might not be willing to do that. It also might be one reason why Apple might seek a partner. We've heard that Apple is looking for a manufacturing partner possibly for their project, that they've talked to, it sounds like, Volkswagen and maybe BMW. But Volkswagen, Mercedes-Benz, Google, Tesla Motors, Nissan, BMW, and Honda all actually have already applied for autonomous vehicle testing permits in the state of California. So they already have those. So if Apple could partner up with someone, they could kind of get that without having to leak, you know, a lot of details about what their project is. And as a matter of fact, BMW might be that preferred partner, as there is a rumor also that Apple had been considering BMW's electric i3 platform as a basis for the Apple Car project. And all of this could not come to fruition at all, because another route Apple could go is they could keep the testing totally private. There are private testing facilities. And if you remember back a while ago, we talked about the fact that there was a rumor that Apple had talked to a company called Gomentum Station They have a 2,100-acre facility on a former naval base in the San Francisco Bay Area that's run by the Contra Costa Transportation Authority, where Apple could do private testing and not have to go through the autonomous vehicle testing permit through, you know, with the state of California, at least not initially. I would imagine ultimately they're going to have to get that permit and test on roads in the state of California, public roads. But for now, they might be able to get away with doing some early testing just privately. But regardless, this project does seem to be moving forward. It does seem to be expanding. We continue to hear about Apple hiring more engineers and more people to work on the project, which is codenamed Project Titan. It's also been said this week that Apple might be looking at a new property it purchased in San Jose last month for $138 million as a development and eventual assembly facility for an Apple car. Bloomberg reported back in February that they expect Apple to try and begin production on a car in as early as 2020. That seems a little bit soon to me. And Tim Cook recently went on Stephen Colbert. He did an interview. If you haven't seen it, it's pretty good. You should check it out online. But Colbert did specifically ask Tim about the car project. And of course, Tim continued to be coy on it, although I got the feeling or the sense, you go watch it and tell me what you think. I got the sense it was sort of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yes, everybody knows we're working on a car project, but we're not going to tell you any more information than has already been sort of leaked out. And that is kind of the latest with Apple's car project, at least as we know it this week. I'd love to know what you think about Apple doing a car. Is this really a thing? Is this something that Apple is going to be shipping a car? Or are they going to just work with manufacturing partners? Some people have gone as far as saying, no, they're just working on in-car technology that they plan to license and sort of sell and integrate with other car manufacturers. But I mean, stranger things have happened. How many of us thought that Apple would be in the phone business or get into the TV business or the music business, running a music subscription service? All of these things are sort of outside Apple's main wheelhouse, and they seem to be going fairly well. I often worry that Apple might spread itself too thin, but over and over they seem to prove me wrong. So my fears be darned. I think they are going to work on some sort of car, and you know, would you buy one, and what would the price be? I would imagine it's going to be in the Tesla range, so I might not be able to afford an Apple car even if it comes out. But give me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. As I sit here recording this show, we are just about 10 days away from the release of OS 10 10.11 El Capitan. And one of the questions I had on the last episode of the Maccast was several of you wanted to know, how do I do a clean install of the operating system so that I can sort of start fresh with the OS. And so I covered that. I talked about a few different things. And one of the things I mentioned was not being able to do a clean install from the recovery partition that's built into OS 10. And many of you emailed me to point out that it really is possible, but you might not be able to go directly to the new operating system. So the difference is what I covered last week. I talked about creating a bootable USB or flash drive, you know, installing OS 10 El Capitan onto that, booting off of it, and then doing your erase and clean install. Several people pointed out that you could boot from the recovery partition, then erase the main partition on your Mac and do a clean install of your current operating system there. Then after you reboot and set things back up new, you know, set up everything as a new Mac, you could run the update to the latest operating system, downloading it via the Mac App Store, and do the upgrade there. So that would be one way to kind of do a clean install. The one thing there is you're actually not erasing the whole hard drive, right? You're just erasing the current main partition. You're keeping the old recovery partition around. I don't know if that gets rebuilt, or I don't know what happens to that as you're reinstalling the operating system. So I still think my method, if you want to completely start from fresh, is a way to go. But someone else pointed out that you could do it a different way, where you don't actually have to build the recovery disk. And I thought this was clever, because if you have a super duper or a carbon copy cloner backup, you could simply boot from that. And then after booting from that, erase and clean install a version of the latest operating system onto your main hard drive. And Randy pointed that out to me. You know, he said it's the easiest way to do a clean install. You basically update your clone drive with SuperDuper. So make sure, you know, SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner has run and totally updated your clone drive, which you want to do anyway because that's part of your backup. Boot off of that, then wipe your internal drive and install the new operating system onto that, because you could download, you know, as you're booted on your SuperDuper partition or your Carbon Copy Cloner partition, you could download the new OS and then install it onto your main drive, and then simply reboot into your main drive and you'll be up and running with the new operating system. So that is another way to go, and I thought that was a good suggestion. And then another thing that was pointed out to me is I had mentioned that, you know, Apple has a command line, a terminal tool for actually creating that bootable USB stick or flash drive. Somebody pointed out that the latest version of Carbon Copy Cloner actually has a create installer feature built into it that will allow you to create a bootable drive once you've downloaded the latest OS X installer application. Now, I'm not 100% certain that it's been updated for OS X El Capitan, but I think it has, because Carbon Copy Cloner itself has been updated to support El Capitan. So if you need to build a bootable disk, you might give that a try, especially if you're a Carbon Copy Cloner owner. I also talked about DiskMaker X, which is the current tool, GUI tool, that will allow you to make a bootable disk or a bootable USB stick or flash drive with the operating system. Listener Ken emailed me saying that he discovered a trick when he was working with the beta builds that allows you to use DiskMaker X, the current version, even though it hasn't been fully updated to support the latest version of the operating system. It says what you can do is basically just rename the installer file. So once you've downloaded OS X El Capitan, the installer, go into the applications folder and just rename the file, whatever it is, install OS X Yosemite. And then what will happen is DiskMaker X will work just fine, because it will think that it's simply building a bootable copy of OS X Yosemite. But since the source file is actually the new El Capitan source file, it will update from there. Now, I will tell you on this one, try it at your own risk, because it is not officially supported by the developer of DiskMaker X, although he does make a note of it in a blog post that some people are having some success with this little trick. So that might be another thing you give a try. Again, I think really the best way to do it is the way I outlined and described in the last episode of the MacCast. So if you missed that, go back and listen, because there is a create disk command line tool that you can run in OS X, that's an official Apple tool, and it will actually build that bootable disk. But a few different ways to try this out. And then the only other thing on doing a clean install of the operating system, I talked about the fact that, you know, clean installing your applications, one thing you probably want to do is make a list or just do an assessment of what apps you want to reinstall, and that also you probably want to get a hold of any product keys or any other information you need when you're reinstalling those applications to make it easier on yourself for getting things set back up. Several people pointed out that, you know, a good way to do this would be to use like a password manager or some sort of tool that will allow you to store the product keys and information for your software. And I actually do this. I'm a 1Password user, as you probably know, and 1Password has a really great system for managing all of your software and your software keys. So I actually put all of my keys in 1Password, and I sync everything with Dropbox. With 1Password, you could also do syncing of your your 1Password database using iCloud. But either of those methods, if you're using them, a good way after doing the clean install to kind of get things back up and running again would be to, if you're using Dropbox, reinstall Dropbox and then reinstall 1Password, get your syncing set back up, and then you will have access to all of your product keys on your new clean system. If you're using iCloud Sync, obviously you can skip the install Dropbox first step. But the point is if you do this in the right order, you can kind of get back up and running more quickly, and you'll have all of your information there digitally versus having to make a list and sort of write everything down. So that might save you some time. So I thought there were some great tips there, and I appreciate everyone who sent in feedback on doing a clean install. Another thing that set off I'm going to go ahead and call it what it was, a barrage of feedback, was my statements and comments about Apple's iPhone payment plans. Specifically, I talked about in the last episode about the fact that I prefer to just buy my devices outright now that I've reached a point in my life where I don't want to be on a payment plan. I don't want to rent or lease my products. And I think many people kind of took issue with the word lease, me using that word. It seemed to be kind of a pain point. I just wanted to address that. And the reason I do is because really on this show, I hope I wasn't introducing any personal bias. That wasn't the intent. If you want to use a payment plan, if you want to use the mobile payment plan from your cell provider, or you want to use Apple's payment plan, it really doesn't matter to me. I was just sharing personally what my choice was, and that's my choice only. It doesn't have to be your choice. And I want to be very clear about that. I also, you know, hope that what I was trying to do is just give you all of the information and facts about how these plans work so that you can kind of make a informed decision. Now, the one thing I do want to do is defend my use of the word lease. Many people pointed out it's not a lease because there's no fees or there's no interest, which is somewhat accurate. And we're going to get into some of those details here in a second. But I want to just point out the term lease and what it actually means. If you look up the word lease in Apple's own dictionary, here's what you get. A contract by which one party conveys land, property, services, and in this case we're talking about property because it's an iPhone, to another for a specified time, usually in return for a periodic payment. So all it is someone giving you a device in exchange for a periodic payment. So that fits well within the term lease. It's also pointed out that by many people that, you know, you're not leasing because after 24 months, you pay it off and you own it. So that kind of doesn't fit in, you know, the realm of a lease when you think of, say, like leasing an apartment or something like that, right? You get the right to live in it in exchange for a payment, but it's never something you actually own. So I guess technically we could say rent to own versus lease, but I thought or felt that rent to own had even an even more negative connotation than lease, which is why I chose the word lease. And actually, I did a little more research on this, and Apple officially calls it a loan, an installment loan. So if you're more comfortable with that, I think we'll go with Apple's official term. So Apple's payment plan is an installment loan. But the point is still valid that until you've actually paid off that loan, you don't own the device. So you could, you know, while you could technically, while you're still under the loan, turn around and sell your iPhone, you'd still be on the hook to pay Apple for any remaining payments, right? So you're always sort of paying out for those 24 months. And if you do the whole trade-in option after 12 months, you restart another 24-month payment period. So you're on this perpetual sort of payment plan for your device, which again is fine, but that's just how the program works, right? And you just need to be aware of that. The other thing is this concept of it's a 0% interest loan, because if you take the 24 payments and you take the amounts that you're going to pay out, and Apple's system does include Apple Care Plus, and I think we talked about that in the last episode. So you take the full price of the phone, you add in the price of the Apple Care Plus, you divide it by 24, and you get the payments that you're going to pay. So over the 24-month period, if you make all those payments, you will have paid the same amount as if you had paid on day one, which is great, right? It sounds like a 0%, zero interest loan. Unfortunately, again, as I dug into this deeper, there's a trick here as well, because in order to get on Apple's payment plan, you have to give them a credit card to auto pay for the payments. So you'll sign up for the payment plan, you have to give them a credit card, and they do not allow debit, corporate, or prepaid cards. Those are not accepted. So it does have to be a credit card that you already have. So you're going to have a credit card to take advantage of this program. You're still going to have to pass a credit check to get in on the program. And that means that, yes, while you're getting zero interest on the payments you're making to Apple, they're going on your credit card. So depending upon what your credit card interest rate is, if you're not the type of person who pays off the balance on your credit card in full and every month, you're going to be paying the interest rate on that money on your card. And I don't know how it is globally, but in the US, a lot of cards can be 18 to 20, higher than 20% on the interest rate. So just be aware of that. If you are going to get into this plan, you're going to want to make sure that you pay off your credit card every month to make sure that you're not paying any interest on your iPhone payments. And then the last thing to note is that in order to be eligible for the upgrade program to trade in your financed phone, according to Apple, it has to be in good physical and operational condition. And the specifics are that is it has to power on and hold a charge. It has to be an intact and functioning display. It has to have no breaks or cracks. And you have to have disabled activation lock, which, you know, that's simple enough. You just, you know, deregister it from iTunes in the cloud. But you do have to take really good care of your device. And I don't know about you, but when I'm walking around, most people I see with iPhones have cracked screens. I would say more than 50% of the time I see someone walking around with a completely cracked screen. Now, we as Apple fans, we probably wouldn't do that. It drives me crazy. I wonder why people don't get them repaired. But, you know, Apple gets to determine the trade-in value of your phone when you go to trade it in after 12 months. So if that doesn't cover the cost of the upgraded phone, you're going to owe the difference. As a matter of fact, if you look into the language under the terms and services, this is what it says. You will owe the difference, if any, between the prevailing reuse and recycling program value at the time of exercising the upgrade option on your original financed iPhone that you trade in, as determined solely by Apple or its trade-in service provider, and the remaining balance of your original installment loan. So big fancy words to say, look, you're going to owe. So if you go in, you're going to upgrade your phone, and Apple says, oh, that's only worth $100, you don't know how much trade-in value they're going to give you. So there's a little bit of a gamble there as well. Again, not a big deal, but just things to be aware of. Another thing, as far as the repairs go, all repairs while you're under the terms of the installment loan plan with Apple have to be done through an Apple store or through an Apple authorized service provider. So that means if you crack your screen, you can't call up, you know, a company like iCracked that gives you a really good deal and get that replaced. Of course, again, if you're on Apple's payment plan, you do get the AppleCare Plus, so you have those two accidental damage incidents where you can pay, I think it's now a $99 fee to have any repairs done. But once you're outside of those, then you're going to be out of pocket and you are going to have to go through an Apple store or an Apple authorized resale provider. And I know a lot of you have emailed me to say, it's really inconvenient for me to get to an Apple store. I don't have an Apple repair center anywhere near me. This is a big pain. So just be aware of that also if you're going on this program. And just to kind of sum things up, again, this is not to pass judgment on Apple's program or anyone who uses it. It's really just to give you the facts. And I really think it's a personal choice. But you should go in eyes wide open and know all of the pluses and minuses. If you are, you know, the type of person who's really good at taking care of their phone, you can easily have any repairs done at an Apple store or an Apple authorized resale center. If you pay off your credit card every month and you are the type of person who wants to upgrade every year, this could be a perfect program for you. It could be the perfect way to go. For me personally, again, this is my personal choice. All these things just sort of complicate everything too much for me. You know, eventually I'm going to pay the full amount anyway. So I just prefer to choose to pay it up front rather than doing increments over a 24-month period. I like to not draw things out. It comes out of my bank account all at once. I'm done. And then at that point, I own the device. I can do whatever I want with it. I can sell it. I can give it away. I can damage it and run around with a cracked screen for as long as I want. I don't have to repair it. I don't have to worry about it. You know, and it's sort of my choice. But again, that's my personal choice. And I'm simply just sharing what I plan to do and why. You make your own decisions based on, you know, the information that you have. Let's talk about iOS 9 because it has come out and there's a lot of stuff in here, and I wanted to kind of dig in and talk about some of the features, some of the things that I'm enjoying and discovering, some of the things that I've read about that maybe I haven't played around with, and just kind of give you a general overview of what I think is good and maybe find out what you think is good and what you're enjoying as well. So one of the big new features, of course, is the updates to Siri and some of what Apple is calling the proactive features. So this is the kind of thing where Siri now can allow you to search through photos and videos by asking about dates and locations and album titles. So you can ask Siri to show you, you know, all my Christmas photos from 2013. You can ask her to show you all the photos from that trip to France you took last year. Just very natural language queries, and it'll bring up that information. So she's getting a lot smarter, a lot more intelligent about the kinds of questions that we're asking. On the more proactive side of things, if you're looking at a web page or you're reading an email and you need a reminder, you can say things like, remind me about this, and she will intelligently interpret what this means. You know, is it the web page you're looking at? Is it the email that you're looking at? And she will adapt the reminder and give information as well as links back to the original content of what you were asked, what you asked her to be reminded about. She can look deeper into some of the information that is on your phone to kind of give you more information about what might be happening specifically. And this is a really cool feature. I've seen it work out with, like if I get an email and there's contact information about somebody in the email, she'll make a suggestion. Hey, I think this is so-and-so's work phone number. It's not in your contact database for them. Do you want me to update it? You can kind of tap a button at the top of the email and update that contact record. Or if you get an incoming phone call and it's from somebody you received an email from and maybe they had a signature with their phone number in it, but their phone number is not in your contact database, she'll say, oh, I think this is so-and-so calling based on some information I found in your email. And that sounds a little bit creepy, but know that Siri is only looking at the internal data on your device. And some people have said this is sort of a plus or a minus, because if you don't have, say, the information on your iPad, the same information on your iPad as you might have on your iPhone, you might get different results. Your results might vary, but it's because it's only looking locally, and that's for security and privacy reasons. Another thing that happens with Proactive that I've seen firsthand that's really great is she can start to suggest apps that you might use at a certain time or a certain place or when certain actions happen. So say you're getting in your car and you always listen to podcasts and maybe even always listen to a specific podcast. She can detect when you connect to your car's Bluetooth that you might want to actually listen to the MacCast on your way to work and suggest, hey, do you want me to, start up the latest episode of the MacCast, those sorts of things. And it's even smart enough to know based on time of day when you might do different things. So say you listen to music on the way home, but podcasts on the way into work, she might suggest a playlist in the evening versus a podcast. And I've seen this happening with Netflix and my Bluetooth headphones. So at night, when I plug in my Bluetooth headset, I'm generally going to watch Netflix. And so when I do that now, automatically, the little Netflix icon pops up in the continuity area on my iPad. Because the system knows, hey, you're probably going to want to, fire up Netflix. And it's just cool time-saving stuff that is really neat. Another thing is with events, you can now have the option to be notified when to leave. So if you have an event with an address in it coming up and there's traffic and it's going to delay your time, you can get a time to leave notification. And it will be adjusted depending upon where you have to go to and traffic conditions. So this is all really, really cool stuff and really handy, and it doesn't all appear right away. So if you've been using iOS 9 and you haven't seen some of this stuff yet, it does need to kind of learn about your patterns and how you use the operating system and things like that before it can start making these proactive suggestions. So hang in there, you'll start to see them. And I think you'll find, like me, when you start to see them, they're really nice little conveniences and little handy things that do save time. So I'm really enjoying that part of the new operating system. Some other significant changes that you might find are related to Spotlight and iOS search. You can now access Spotlight searches and iOS searches by either pulling down like we did in iOS 8, or you can now swipe over to the leftmost screen once again and get to search features there. On the leftmost screen, that's what's called iOS search, and there's a little more Siri recommendations, a little more information there than you typically get with just the Spotlight search, which is more just the one that you swipe down from the main screen. On that iOS search, you get things like place and news suggestions. So you'll see news articles that relate into the Apple News app. Also different suggestions for different kinds of places you might go to. And I guess those place suggestions, again, will start to adapt and get tweaked depending upon where you go and what time of day and where you are, those sorts of things. Also built into Spotlight and iOS search are a bunch of different kinds of links. We now have things called deep links, backlinks, and universal links. And the difference between these is deep links will allow you to open up apps and go to specific points within the apps. So they're links that you can get that will drive you maybe into a specific settings screen or something inside an app. The backlinks, which I think are the ones that I'm finding the most useful, that's a quick way to get back to where you are. So if you're in Mail and you click on a link and it opens up Safari, what you'll notice in the upper left-hand corner of Safari is a link that says back to Mail. So you can kind of look through the Safari link that someone had sent you, get the information, and then jump quickly back right to where you were in your email. And then lastly are these things called universal links. These are more about links on the web that can drive you actually into an iOS app if that website has a companion app. So imagine this for like Twitter, right? You're on the Twitter website, but you're on your iOS device and you have the Twitter app installed. What can happen now is you can click on a link on Twitter and it will actually open up that link inside the Twitter application, the native Twitter application. And it is a universal link, meaning we've had these links before where you can kind of have a Twitter URL. So it might be Twitter /// instead of HTTP/// The way these universal links work is developers actually have to build some information into their website. So it would look on your iOS device just like a standard HTML link, but the website is sort of smart enough to know that you're on an iOS device, that you have the native app installed, and it can automatically drill you into that native app. But the same link might work differently if, say, you're just in your web browser or you're on a PC or something else. It doesn't look visually any different. It's not going to not react if you're in a place where you only have access to a web browser. So that's kind of cool stuff there as well. There are apps that show up inside your Spotlight searches, and you can deep search inside metadata inside apps. And because of that, you can now control what apps are available to see in Spotlight. So if you go into Settings, General, into Spotlight Search, you'll see all of your apps listed there, and you can toggle off apps, any apps you don't want to see in search results. And I found a few that just don't seem to make sense because it seems like it's globally enabled. So I'll have some games. It's like, I really don't need to search inside these games for data or information. It doesn't affect the app launching. So don't worry about that. If you're actually like launching apps from Spotlight Search, which is something I do, that does work. This just seems to be related to any of the lower level metadata. So if you have a photo app or a camera app and you want to search for photos or cameras or pictures or something inside that app, you may want to leave that on. If it's something like Byword or a text editor that you use quite frequently where you have text documents stored locally and you want to be able to search within those, you can do that. You might want to leave that on. Another feature that I probably won't use very much that's in iOS 9 that a lot of people are very happy about, though, is transit directions and transit inside maps. Right now, just so you're aware, it's limited to a few specific areas in the U.S. It's Baltimore, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. I think Apple's working to expand that, and hopefully that expansion will happen pretty rapidly. Outside the United States, they have Mexico City, London, Berlin, Toronto, and over 300 cities in China. So it seems they've very focused on China in terms of the transit directions. Also inside maps now for different places and locations, if they offer up Apple Pay, when you're getting details, you click on the little screen, it will indicate and display with a little icon if a location supports Apple Pay. So that should help with actually finding more Apple Pay retailers. There's some big updates to the Notes application. I'm not a big Notes app user, but maybe I'll become more of one. A lot of people have pointed out that this kind of brings it in line, or at least a little more in line, with things like OneNote or Evernote. Inside the Notes app now, you can actually do sketches. You can add photos. If you share a URL, so if you're in Safari and you use the URL share button, or that use the share button, you can actually share into Notes, and it will create a little graphical link. You can also do that with maps and information. Inside Notes, you can now build checklists, and there's additional formatting tools. So it's a lot more rich text formatted. And if you're in sort of the main list of all your notes, there's now, just like you would have in like Messages, where you can kind of see all of the attachments or the SMSs within a message, within Notes, there's a little attachment browser. So you can see any attachments or additional information, drawings, audio files, video files that are attached to Notes, all kind of in one place, and browse through them. I don't know how that's going to affect storage on Notes. The one thing I did notice when I enabled this feature is that it is limited to iOS 9 and notes in OS X El Capitan. And since we haven't upgraded yet, if you do choose to enable the new notes functionality on your iOS devices, just know that until El Capitan comes out, you're not going to be able to sync or access that additional data on the Mac. So you kind of have to make that decision. It feels a little bit like when we had to choose about iCloud Drive, when we had, you know, iCloud Drive on iOS, but didn't have it on the Mac yet. You know, do you turn it on? Do you start to use it? Because you'll lose access from one side or the other. So just something to be aware of if you're considering using the new Notes functionality. There's a bunch of new security updates in iOS 9. A lot of them under the hood sorts of things, but a few of the front-facing ones that will help you out. When you do set up a passcode on your device, you're now required to use 6 digits instead of 4 digits, so that's going to be more secure. I was always using a longer passcode, so I don't know what the process is if you've been using a 4-digit passcode and you do the upgrade, the over-the-top upgrade. I think it will actually prompt you to create a longer passcode. Some people may find that inconvenient, but it is definitely much more secure, so I think it's a good thing for Apple to push. There's also a lot more and better support for two-factor authentication through iCloud, so if you use that functionality, now when you choose to get a passcode sent to you, it will actually automatically get input. So you receive that text message and then it actually automatically inputs it, so you don't have to do the copy paste or you don't have to kind of look between the message and go back and forth. And Apple did add two-factor authentication support for your Apple ID in iTunes, so you can now use two-factor in iTunes and it's not a really big hassle, so much more secure on that front. Performance overall has been improved with the new update. A lot of people commenting that it feels snappier and faster. I haven't really noticed that a lot, but I can kind of see little things where it's moving faster. More so what people are noticing is battery life. And I've seen this happen both ways. Some people are commenting that they're getting much worse battery life, but most people seem to be commenting that they're getting better battery life. And that's because Apple added a bunch of enhancements in iOS 9 to up the battery, your battery, how long your battery should last on the device. One of the cool features, I think, is it can now detect when it's in face down mode. So if you've got it on a table, and you may want to change your habits. If you're used to kind of putting it face up, which I am, because I usually want to protect the glass. I don't know how I'm going to feel about this, actually, now that I'm really thinking about it. I usually put it on its back, but now I may put it on its face because it can detect that, and in face down mode, if you get a message or you get an alert or something like that, it's not going to turn on the screen because, hey, guess what? You can't see it. It's face down. So that'll help save a little bit on battery. Another feature that iOS 9 brings in is something Apple's calling low power mode. So when your battery gets down to about 20% and then again at 10%, it will ask you if you want to activate low power mode. And you can actually activate low power mode manually. If you go into settings, into battery, you can flip it on manually. But what happens when low power mode is active is the iPhone's battery icon turns yellow. The percentage is displayed, whether you normally display the percentage or not. And then it actually turns off some features and functionality, but not enough that's really going to hinder your actual usage of the device. It keeps Bluetooth and location services running, so you can still get those things. It throttles down the GPU and the CPU to kind of better optimize battery life, so your apps might run a little bit slower, but not anything that I think most people are going to notice. It's going to stop any background apps from running or updating, and that's kind of a real big one, right? It's going to shut down any of those background processes and really limit those. It turns off fetch and push for email. Basically, if you want to get new emails, you're going to have to open up the email application when it's in low power mode. And it forces the auto lock to go on in 30 seconds. And then it also disables AirDrop and continuity. So all things to kind of help you save battery life. And according to Apple, you should be able to get almost like 3 hours additional battery life. Whether that works in practice or not, I haven't really read. I kind of read one report that said they got about 30 minutes extra battery than they would have if they had just gone, you know, straight from the 20% on down. How that works into overall time, I don't really know. And I think Apple, with their 3 hours, they're talking about overall time from 20% to, you know, like nothing. But regardless, that should help in a lot of situations, especially if you're in one of those areas where you can't get to a charger, you've reached the end of the day, you're getting low on power. This will hopefully extend you to get you through the end of the day. Now, one thing to note is that while you can turn on this this feature manually, it appears that for at least right now, once your iPhone reaches an 80% charge, iOS automatically turns off low power mode. So you'd have to go back in and re-enable it. And also, for some reason, Apple has chosen not to have low power mode available on the iPad. This is an iPhone-only feature. So you have that. Another thing, just if you're managing battery, to be aware of is that you can now get a little more detail on battery usage of applications. So if you go into settings and battery, in iOS 8, you could actually see which apps were using battery and how, you know, what percentage of the battery those apps had been using. Now it will actually also show you the amount of battery time in the foreground and in the background for applications. And I think this could be particularly helpful if you have background apps running. If you see one in particular that's using a lot of battery in the background, it may be a good bit of information to use to say, hey, I want to shut that one down because it's using a lot of extra battery. We should probably talk about the news application, although, to be honest with you, I haven't really used it all that much. So there's a new news application where you can subscribe to and get information from different sources. It makes a bunch of recommendations to you. It's kind of like Apple's version of Flipboard or maybe the Facebook Pages application, right? These sorts of things, or even to a certain degree, Pocket. But you know, I haven't particularly found it useful, but I think it's just because that's not how I choose or want to discover news. I think it's great if you're the type of person who's just looking for some recommendations, some articles to read and things like that, and you certainly should check it out. I think visually it's beautiful. I tried to play around with it, but for me, I'm still an RSS feed guy. I'm an RSS news reader guy, and I kind of have my process that works for me for consuming and finding news. And it works well. So that might just be some of the curmudgeon in me. I'd be curious to hear anybody who's really using and finding the new news application really useful. But it is kind of a nice new app. And especially, again, if you're into just general discovery, it's, if you're a browsing type person, I think it's probably great. Of course, you have the new iPad stuff, slide over and picture in picture. I think we've covered these pretty well. If you don't know what these are yet, you should check out Apple's website for kind of details. And then if you're on an iPad Air 2 or you have a new iPad Mini 4, you've got the split screen mode. And of course, that's going to work when the new iPad Pro gets here. So you can now work side by side with two applications at the same time. Whereas like with slide over, you just kind of pull one section over on a third of the screen, you can maybe check your Twitter feed and then go back to what you're working on. It's a little more modal and that sort of thing. Updates to the keyboard. The keyboard now has what's being called a new shortcuts bar. I think this is specifically and mostly on the iPad. What you get is some additional icons up to the left and right of the quick type area. And you get things like cut, copy, paste, or share buttons. These actually really adapt to depend upon the application that you're using. So in some cases, you might have undo, you might have formatting tools. It's going to vary depending upon what you're using. And many times, you can press and hold on these icons to get a little pop-up, a contextual pop-up of some additional options. So don't be afraid to play around with that. For hardware keyboards, Apple has tried to kind of consolidate a lot of the command keys and the shortcuts. So you could use command key shortcuts, and there's a new discoverability cheat sheet that you can check out. So if you just simply hold down the command key, it will show you the shortcut options for whatever application you're working in. And once again, these are going to vary from app to app, but your typical ones, cut, copy, paste, command C, command V, you know, command P, and probably undo, command Z, all of those probably should work across most applications. And again, if you have a keyboard attached, you also can switch between applications using the command tab key like we have on OS X. So despite the operating systems still being very different, at least when a keyboard comes into play, and I think this kind of goes into what we were talking about earlier, right, about the Apple's philosophy that the iPad for a lot of people is going to replace the notebook. Apple's trying to bring in some of that familiarity to the operating system and to using the device specifically when you have a keyboard attached. So that's kind of a significant update here. Another thing most people in the notice almost right away is how Apple is handling the shift key now is a lot more obvious. The shift key normally is hollow with a little arrow pointing up. When you tap on it now, it turns white with a filled in arrow. Double tapping, you get the little line underneath it so that it's very obvious that you're in the cap locks mode. And to further reinforce that, you now see uppercase keys when you have the shift key on and lowercase keys when the shift key is not on. And some people don't like this change. If you're one of those people, you can actually change it. It's not in the keyboard settings, though. It's actually part of accessibility. So you have to go into settings, general accessibility, and then under keyboard, and you can turn off the show lowercase keys option. And then something that's been part of iOS, the iOS keyboard forever, is the little character previews, you know, where as you're typing, specifically on the iPhone, but I think it happens on the iPad as well. As you're typing, you get the little pop-up so you can see which key your finger is on, right? You get a little pop-up thing. If you find that distracting or you don't like that, you can now disable that, and you can disable it in the settings general keyboard. The option is called character preview, and you can just toggle that off. And then another thing related to the keyboard on the iPad specifically is the ability to use it as a trackpad. So you can now place two fingers on the keyboard when you're editing text, and that will allow you to move the cursor around the screen. It will also allow you to make selections, and I find that that can be a lot faster than having to tap and use the little magnifying glass and the little handles and things like that. So I am actually really enjoying the trackpad feature on the iPad. I think that's a huge time saver. And then Safari in iOS 9 has received a few really nice updates. One, if you have a link copied to the keyboard, a URL, and you tap and hold on the address bar area, there is now a new paste and go option. So you can paste and immediately go to that link. Or if you have just a general word or a term in the clipboard, you tap and hold and it will give you paste and search. So you can save a couple clicks there, or a couple taps there when doing that. And the reverse works as well. So if you need to copy a URL, rather than having to kind of double tap and select the whole thing, go through that whole rigmarole, if you just tap and hold on the URL bar area, you will get a copy option for that URL. Because iOS now has support, iOS 9 now has support for content blockers. You may have read about this in the news. Marco Arment and Peace made some headlines this week. If you haven't seen that, just do a Google search for that and get caught up on that. But basically, Apple added the ability for third-party ad and content blockers to be used with Safari. And the way these work is you actually have to purchase one from the App Store or download one, put it on your device, and then when you go into the Safari settings, you can enable them and turn them on. And typically you go into the app to do all the controls, tell it what kind of blocks and information you want on, and then you enable them from the Safari settings, and then they will start to work. But as you're browsing around, you may find that you have a website you want to load without the content blockers for one reason or another. Luckily, Apple has added a quick shortcut for that. If you tap and hold on the refresh icon in Safari, you can get the option to reload the page without content blockers. It's also now where you get the option to request the desktop version of the site. So if you've ever been at a site and they're showing you a mobile version, but you really want to see the desktop version, this is a quick way to get in and switch over and see the full desktop version. Apple also added a nice little security feature to the Safari bar in iOS 9. Now, if you go to a website, or if you might potentially go to a website that's suspected of having a phishing scam on it, it's going to show the entire top URL bar area in bright red to kind of warn you, hey, this is a suspected phishing site. So much in the same way that I think Chrome and some other browsers have done this before, but it's nice to see Apple finally bringing this to Safari on iOS. And then just a few more odds and ends related to iOS 9, a few lesser known features. You can now search inside settings. So if you've ever gone into the settings menu and not really known where to go, there is a search bar in there. You can pull down and just do a quick search to find the control panel that you're looking for or the settings that you're looking for. On the iPad, if you use folders, you may notice that you can now have 4x4 icons in a folder versus 3x3, so a little more room for getting your icons in a folder. New folder for selfies and screenshots inside the Photos application. This is really handy to just kind of better organize, especially for someone like me who's constantly taking screenshots and doing little annotations to show people things. Now all of that's not going to be commingled in or mixed in with my photos. Of course, it is in the All Photos area, but if I'm just browsing through different different sections, I can keep that stuff separated or quickly find those screenshots and purge them out of my iPhone. Home sharing is back in Music. Yes, finally. You may have trouble finding it, though. So to get to it, tap on My Music and then tap on the little dropdown that lets you switch between songs and artists and albums. And then down there at the bottom, you'll see the home sharing option. And you can tap on that and then select your home sharing server if you're using home sharing on iTunes. Remember, that was lost with the iTunes 8.4.1 update. It's now back in iOS 9. You now have the ability to have an iCloud Drive app on your phone. I think you'll be prompted for it, to turn it on. I actually was when I upgraded to iOS 9, but in case you missed it or you dismissed it, if you want to turn it on manually, if you go into settings into iCloud, you will see iCloud Drive there and you can turn on the option for show on home screen. So you can add that icon to your home screen and quickly access any files that you might have in your iCloud Drive. In iOS 9, you can also zoom in now on a video, much in the same way that you would with a photo, so you can do the whole pinch to zoom thing. Now, I noticed for me, at least, this only worked inside the Photos application. Maybe it'll work on videos playing inside Safari as well. But basically, it did not work for any like movies that I had purchased through iTunes. I couldn't zoom in on a movie, but maybe that was just me. I tried it a couple times. I couldn't figure out how to get it to work, but it worked perfectly fine inside the Photos application. iCloud Photo Library now shows the size of your downloads and uploads. Thank goodness. So now you can actually kind of see what's going on when you're syncing files back and forth between iCloud Photo Library. You're not just going to kind of be in the dark there. A change in Siri that I didn't notice right away is that she no longer does her little double beep when you activate Siri. So you no longer get the deek deek sound, right? You just get actually a double vibration. That is, I don't know how I feel about that. I think a lot of people like it because you can use Siri a little bit more privately, right? You don't have to press on the button and then you hear that sound and everybody kind of looks over at you and knows that you're using Siri. The double chime does still come into play though if you use the hands-free Siri command. The Siri, I never know how to say this. We got to come up with code word for this. I think generally on the iOS show, we use Hola Siri, but I don't know if that still sets off your phone. So if you use Hola Siri, you still will get the familiar little double chime. But if you're just pressing the home button, expect only to get a double vibration. And I didn't mention the new Siri UI either, right? You get the new kind of colored sound bar with Siri. I think it's a lot prettier. I like it better than the other visualization, but it certainly is a change. And another cool little Siri tweak is that if you've activated Siri using the button and you've done a command and the microphone icon is still up on the screen, you can now say Hola Siri even if you're not plugged into power, and Siri will respond. So once she's kind of in Siri mode, it seems like the always listening option is turned on, and you can continue to use Siri until you're done and you move away from that screen. So something else to be aware of. Inside notifications, you can now control the sort order a little bit more, and specifically notifications appear to be sorted in chronological order. So if you go into settings, into notifications, you will see sort order, and you can sort by recent or manually. And you can also toggle whether you want to have notifications grouped by app, by application or not. And I noticed that by default, it looks like they are not grouped together anymore, which actually I find very convenient. I like seeing them sort of in reverse chronological order so that I know kind of the order they came in, regardless of whatever application they came in on. And then the last little tweak that I've noted so far is that inside the Photos application, now when you're doing a selection, so you click the edit button, you need to select a group of photos, you can actually swipe to highlight a whole bunch of images. You can just drag your finger over it and it'll put all the little blue check marks on it. So you don't have to go, you know, one by one and select those. So nice little tweaks on that. Overall, I'm pretty happy with the iOS 9 update. I am going to mention something here in a minute that I ran into that was a little bit frustrating, but I think it's an isolated issue. But keep in mind also that as I've gone over all these features, not all of the features are available in all countries or on all devices, so your mileage may vary. So if you heard the latest episode of the Mac Show, you probably heard me ranting about my issues with iOS 9. And I was pretty upset on that day. I've had a chance to kind of come back from it and realize that really it was just me. I didn't think it was just me. My friend Victor Cahiao has also reported kind of having some issues with iOS 9, and some of you have as well. I've received some emails from some folks who have said they've had nothing but kind of problems with iOS 9, with crashes, with battery issues, with various issues, including the one I'm about to tell you now. So what happened to me was that I did my iOS 9 update, and then I did what I often do, which is get in my car and start to listen to podcasts. And the way I listen to podcasts is I usually ask Siri to start up the podcast application or start playing a podcast. And I got in the car right after upgrading to iOS 9 and found that, oh, Siri wasn't working. Well, it turns out, and this is something to be aware of when you upgrade, Siri has this new training process, so you can kind of train the Hola Siri feature to recognize your voice, I guess, a little bit better. And so you go through this training procedure. I didn't realize that once you upgrade, even if you had prior to that been using that feature, that it gets turned off and you have to re-enable it and kind of go through the wizard to set up Siri. And that may be something that came up during the upgrade, you know, sort of setup process, and I may have skipped over it because I was trying to get my iPhone back up and running. So you may also be prompted to do it right during setup. But regardless, it wasn't turned on. So that was fine. I turned it on, got it working, although it was working very unreliably. I was trying to use the command, and it was only being recognized maybe 20% of the time. And the other 80% of the time, Siri was not responding whatsoever. So I got continually frustrated, and which is not something you want to be doing when you're driving. So ultimately, I ended up pulling over to kind of troubleshoot this thing. Because the next thing that happened was I was playing the podcast app, and I wanted to skip back because I missed something someone had said, and I wanted to, you know, use the skip back button. And I looked down and I noticed that the buttons were missing. Not only were the skip forward and back buttons missing, but also the sleep timer button was not being displayed as well. Interestingly enough, I noticed that if I tapped in the areas where those buttons should be, that the functionality still worked. So it was still functional, but visually there was no indicators that anything was there. So I got extremely frustrated about that, and I sort of commented about that on the Mac Show, and then everybody pointed out that they were not having the same issue, that they had upgraded to iOS 9, and their icons were there just fine. So this was obviously an issue isolated to my iOS device, and the suggestion was, well, why don't you just do an erase and reinstall and restore from backup? That should clear everything up, and you should have a clean installation of the app. And that sounded logical to me, so I did that actually live during the show. And lo and behold, the issue was still there. Everything was still broken. The icons were still missing. So the ultimate fix for me was to actually have to do an erase, an install of the operating system, and a setup the device as new, which I absolutely hate because you lose all kinds of settings. I lose all my mail account settings. You have to reset all that stuff up. If you have any applications that don't store their data or sync their data through the cloud, you lose that data. Very often when I do this process, there's applications that I don't even realize that I've lost data in until weeks or maybe sometimes even months later, depending upon how frequently I use those applications. And I guess that kind of says to me, you know, maybe you don't use those applications frequently enough to be worried about that. But if you are going to go through this process, I would just say be aware that you could lose some data. But I'm also going to say that if you found that you're having iOS 9 issues, because a lot of the people that I've talked to have said they aren't having issues, I think that for those of us who are having issues, we are in an isolated and small group, and it may be related to just overall corruption over time of our operating system. So simply doing an over-the-top install or even restoring from backup is kind of bringing back some of the issues and things that we may or may not have known that we had. I didn't know I was having issues in iOS 8.4, but obviously something was going on. And maybe those icons were even missing before I did the upgrade. I have no way to go back and kind of figure that out. But regardless, a clean erase, install, and setup as new may be the path that you have to go down. And if you do go down that path, just a couple of things to be aware of. You'll need to reactivate iCloud and all of your email accounts. You'll also need to reset up Touch ID and Siri. You're going to have to reload all your applications. But for me, that turned out to be a really good thing because I realized I had over 200, almost 300 applications on my iPhone, and I really don't use that many. So I used this opportunity to really purge down my applications and only reinstall the apps that I knew I was actively using. And then I figure anything else that I sort of casually used, I'll re-download when the time comes, when it's like, oh, I need to use that app, I'll re-download it. And I've already had that happen a couple times. If you do have apps that don't sync their data through the cloud and that data doesn't come back, one thing that you might have to do is go back and use a tool like PhoneView or iExplorer to actually extract the data before you do the clean install, before you do the erase and setup as new. You're going to want to go through, identify those applications, extract any data using one of those apps, and then once you've reinstalled the application on your new clean device, restore that data back into the data files. If you didn't pull that data out before, you could use something like iPhone Backup Extractor to maybe go back and recover that data from backups. But just be aware of that if you're going through this process. For the rest of everybody else, if you haven't upgraded to iOS 9 yet, just some quick updates on how to prepare for upgrading. Backup to iCloud if you're going to use it before you do your upgrade. Also, as I mentioned earlier, backup via iTunes and make sure you check the encrypt iPhone backup option because that's going to allow you to save account passwords and health data into your backup. And then I also recommend backup the backup, right? Run your standard OS X backup and make sure you have a backup of the iPhone backup that you just pulled. And then once you've done that, you can go ahead and download and install the update. And you can either do that over the air. I prefer doing it through iTunes, although the iTunes process seems to take a little bit longer because it actually does kind of erase and restore the device if you choose to do the restore option, which I would recommend if you're going through iTunes because that's going to be a kind of cleaner way. Just be aware, you know, you're going to have a much longer process as you wait for everything to go back. Of course, you could just do the over-the-top upgrade and be done with it a little bit more quickly, but that option is totally up to you. Now that iOS 9 is out, I think you have questions as well. I'm starting to get several via email, and I welcome you to send those along. This week, actually, I did get a question about iOS 9 and restrictions that came in from Tony.
Hi, Adam. My name is Tony. I first listened to your podcast in 2013, and I've been hooked ever since. It's a wonderful podcast. The reason I called was to ask for your help on the topic of parental controls in iOS, also known as restrictions. More specifically, restrictions in iOS 9, which was released on the 16th. A while back, in 2014, I think, I purchased an iPod Touch, 5th gen. It was a really sweet device, but there was a problem. Now, I'm still a kid, and my parents wanted to have parental controls. We looked up that topic on Apple's website and saw all the things that restrictions could block on iOS. It looked good, so I bought the device. Now, once I got it and updated to iOS 8.1, which was the latest version of iOS back then, we set up parental controls. That's when we realized it had major, major holes. Like it didn't block iTunes Radio, with all the album covers that can come through in that. Sure, there's a block explicit song setting, but if the song is clean and the album cover is inappropriate, it will come through. The podcast app, which lets you search iTunes catalog of podcasts, both video and audio, can't be blocked by parental controls. You can't even block the podcast browsing functionality of the app. Siri, which can search the web and pull down images, has a setting to block explicit content. The only problem is that, it's been a while actually, but I think the problem with that setting was that it was not under the restriction settings, but actually just out in the open, which would allow anyone who didn't have the parental controls pin to change that Siri setting. Not so good. I don't want to block Siri completely, I just want to block explicit content that might come through Siri. I feel like there was another hole, but I can't remember it at the moment. My family doesn't have any iOS devices, as I returned the iPod, so what I wanted to ask was, did iOS 9 fix any of these problems? Similar to how Greg suggested that we all give feedback to Apple to bring back the Shuffle by Album feature, I would like to strongly encourage MacCast listeners to give feedback to Apple, asking them to get the whole parental controls thing done right and to maintain restrictions well, keeping it up to date with all the new features in the upcoming releases of iOS. Thanks, Adam, and keep up the good work.
Hey, thanks, Tony. I appreciate the voicemail comment. And, you know, this is a somewhat tricky subject, I think, because as you're finding out, it's very hard to sort of block everything. And I think more importantly for Apple is determining what to block, and they have to sort of become the curators of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And that's a tough thing to do because different people have different interpretations of what is explicit and maybe what is not explicit. I guess I should start by maybe answering your questions directly. So you're absolutely right. Album covers and those sorts of things on iTunes Radio or even within iTunes, they are not blocked for content as near as I can tell. So even if you said don't allow explicit lyrics, that doesn't necessarily apply to the album covers. And I've discovered the same issue with iBooks as well. You can sort of set, or even movies or TV shows, you can set minimum levels, like only allow G-rated movies or, you know, PG-rated movies, or you can say only allow these sorts of books or block, you know, adult content books. But very often, browsing and search results will come back with inappropriate covers or other information that you can see. On the Siri side of things, you're right. Siri can block explicit language, but I don't think it does anything to restrict images if you're doing like an image search. Now, that being said, I turned on the restrictions and off the restrictions and tried to see if I could get inappropriate images to show up in a Siri results, and I couldn't seem to do it. Now, again, I don't know what your definition of an explicit image would be. I was looking for sort of adult images using Siri searches, and those results come back from Bing. So I don't know if maybe controlling the web restrictions would limit that. If you, you know, limited the or blocked adult content, would that carry over into those Bing image searches? I don't really know. But once again, the trouble here is that definition could be different for everyone. Like, is nudity in Native American tribes okay or not okay? Some people might say yes, some people might say no. Same thing for artwork. You know, is it okay in a Renaissance painting, but not if it's coming from a pornographic website? Where do you draw that line? And that's really the tricky thing to do. So bringing it back to Apple and asking them to do more with their parental controls, I think you'd kind of have to get really specific with them in their recommendation. I'm not saying don't do it. I think people should. If you feel like there's something that's missing, you should absolutely give the feedback to Apple. And I would encourage every MacCast listener to do that. But you need to be very specific about what you're asking for, what the control you're asking for is, so that they can understand what you're looking for. And I do think overall that Apple is doing better than many other providers, at least with their built-in controls that you get right out of the box. Now, maybe on Android, there might be some better tools that are third-party apps. But again, better is going to be up to interpretation. Some people might prefer a lot more granular control or more specific controls. Some people might want wider or broader controls that sort of block things ad hoc. I'm trying to remember, I think I forgot to mention about the podcasts. Podcasts that are tagged as explicit in iOS 9, this maybe is a change from what you saw before. Those are blocked. That setting, though, is grouped in with music, podcasts, news, and iTunes U. So I don't, once again, know if it'll stop you from searching or seeing the results of explicit podcasts or if it just sort of blocks subscribing. But getting back to this feedback concept, and, you know, maybe there are some parental control things that are better on, you know, Android with third-party apps. Apple does constantly try to improve, I think, and update their restriction settings and their parental control settings, but I think there's always going to be holes depending upon your specific desires or the things that you're specifically looking to block. So I do think in this general area of parental controls and restrictions, there's kind of a balance between technology and also just trust and responsibility. And just based on hearing your voicemail, it sounds like you're a very responsible kid and probably have a very open and good communication relationship with your parents. And you kind of understand the things that are probably appropriate for you and not appropriate for you. So the parental controls can work as sort of a first tier of protection, but I think ultimately, too, you're going to have to kind of bring in your own common sense and, you know, the oversight of your parents to kind of fill in the holes that are there and understand that, yeah, you might see something that's inappropriate, but you just sort of turn away from it or look away from it or move away from it rather than diving down deeper into it. I think you'll never be able to block everything, especially when you have content coming from the web. There's always going to be stuff that slips through. Unfortunately, there's nefarious people that tag things or get by controls. A lot of those parental controls, again, like the explicit language controls in podcasts, those depend on me as a podcaster either marking my podcast as clean or explicit. I could just simply not do that and stuff could simply slip through. So there's going to be things that happen. And I really think the key is having that relationship with your kids where you've discussed what is expected when the content is sort of encountered and give them the tools that they need to kind of deal with the stuff that's going to slip through and have an open conversation and talk about it. And again, every family is going to determine what is appropriate and not appropriate based on their own values and morals and things like that. And I think part of the problem for Apple in enabling more controls or being more restrictive with controls is kind of figuring out where to draw that line and not wanting to take it so far that they end up in an area where they're being accused of downright censorship. It is a tricky line and it's a tricky subject, but I hope this all makes sense. But certainly, if there are big holes, like I know one that people commonly mention on iOS is the ability to do timed controls. So on the Mac, you can set up times for doing screen time. And screen time is becoming a big issue with kids and parents, is how much screen time is appropriate, when is screen time appropriate, when are they allowed to use the device and not use the device. It'd be nice to see some of those controls coming to iOS, and I think that would be great feedback to give to Apple. But certainly I agree too on the album covers, and this may be fixed. I mentioned the books and movies and TV shows. It might be fixed over there, but it certainly isn't for album covers, because I was able to find some with some blatant nudity, even when the parental controls were turned on for that. And I know that that is something that many people would deem inappropriate for children of a certain age. So certainly Apple can do a little bit better job, but I think overall they're doing well. And I agree. Let's give them some feedback when we think they can improve things. So just apple.com/feedback in case you're wondering. And thanks, Tony, for your voicemail message. And the last thing I have to talk to you about today is, unfortunately, some nasty malware that has surfaced recently. And normally I wouldn't talk about this stuff because it's normally pretty isolated, but this one has the potential to be a pretty big problem for a number of iOS users, specifically because it impacts the application WeChat. What's happened is Palo Alto Networks has discovered a nasty Chinese malware called Xcode Ghost that was found in unauthorized infected copies of Apple's Xcode tools. These are the tools that are used by developers. And unfortunately, some Chinese developers used this exploited tool to compile their applications and submit them to the App Store. The malicious code was in a version of Xcode that was uploaded to the Chinese cloud file sharing site Baidu. And some Chinese developers then unknowingly compiled their iOS apps and using the modified Xcode IDE and submitted them to the App Store. And apparently the reason this happens is that developers in China sometimes turn to alternative servers because Xcode is a very large download. It's several gigabytes from what I remember, and it can take a really long time to download over Apple's servers in China. And so they go to these other local servers to try and get the software. And I guess this has been common. It hasn't been a problem in the past, but this time around, somebody stuck a version up there that had this malware injected into it. And unfortunately, because these are legitimately compiled apps that have gone through Apple's Apple's App Store vetting process, it does affect both stock and jailbroken devices. And Palo Alto Networks has found a list of at least 35 infected iOS apps so far, most of them only in China, but there are apps like WeChat, NetEase, Cloud Music, WinZip, and a whole bunch more. I'll link to the full list in the show notes at maccast.com. Because the problem is if you have one of these infected apps, the Xcode Ghost malware can start to collect information about your device, and then it encrypts and uploads that data to a couple of command and control servers that are run by the attackers. And so it can get things like the current time, the current infected app's name, the app bundle identifier, the device's name and type, the system's language and country, the device's UUID, which is the unique ID for that iOS device, the type of network it's on. And then, unfortunately, also it can send back commands to the device, including doing things like throwing up a prompt, fake alert to try and phish for user credentials, logins, and other, you know, personal information. It can hijack opening specific URLs and could allow for exploitation of vulnerabilities in the iOS system or within other iOS apps. It can read and write data from your clipboard, which could be used to read your password and any passwords that might be copied into the clipboard from password management tools. So there's some pretty significant exploits that can happen if you got impacted by this. Now, as I said, most of the apps appear to be in China only, but Mac Rumors noted that Camcard, which is like a popular business card reader and scanner app available in the U.S. and several other countries, is also on that list. And as I mentioned, WeChat was also impacted, and that's a very popular global chat app. And the flaw, just so you know, if you are a WeChat user, it's in version 6.2.5 of the app, so you'll want to update to 6.2.6 to get the fix, to get the version without the exploit in it. And Palo Alto Networks is working with Apple on the issue. They're also, have notified several developers that have been impacted, and those developers are working to update their apps to remove the malware. So if you have any of the infected apps, what you want to do is either immediately uninstall them if they don't have an update to patch the exploit, or update them to the newer version with the removed malware. Again, I'll have a link in the show notes where you can get the full list. And then, just as an added precaution, if you did have an infected app on your device, it's possible you could have been exploited. So you probably want to reset your iCloud password and any other passwords that you might have input on your device, which would include copying and pasting from, say, an app like 1Password. You're going to want to reset those passwords while you had the infected app on your device. Hopefully this doesn't impact too many people, but I felt it was serious enough to warrant a discussion and a mention here on the MacCast. So with that sort of downer note, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Hopefully all the other great content in this episode made up for that, and hopefully you didn't get impacted by this virus. But with that, that will do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, Disk Label, PDF Pen, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And TunnelBear. TunnelBear is a really simple VPN app that allows you to browse privately and get around blocked websites. You can try it today by going to tunnelbear.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at BackbeatMedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me an email or send me an audio comment to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on the social medias, you want to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or you can check out our Google Plus community. You'll find that at google.com/plusMacCast. And that is the plus symbol, MACCAST. Look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again. Real.